Okay. So the text that we have is 1 Corinthians 15, verse 58. But it's important that we read slightly more than that. Because it starts with therefore, it kind of implies that we need to read the bit that goes before. So we're actually going to start our reading in verse 35, the start of the previous section. But someone will ask, how are the dead raised, and with what kind of body will they come? How foolish. What you sow does not come to life unless it dies. When you sow, you do not plant the body that will be, but just a seed, perhaps of wheat or of something else. But God gives it a body as he determined. And to each kind of seed he gives its own body. Not all flesh is the same. People have one kind of flesh, animals have another, birds another, and fish another. There are also heavenly bodies, and there are earthly bodies. But the splendor of the heavenly bodies is of one kind, and the splendor of the earthly bodies is another. The sun has one kind of splendor, the moon another, and the stars another, and star differs from star in splendor. So will it be with the resurrection of the dead. The body that is sown is perishable, it is raised imperishable. It is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness, it is raised in power. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. If there is a natural body, there is also a spiritual body. So it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living being. The last Adam, a life-giving spirit. The spiritual did not come first, but the natural. And after that, the spiritual. The first man was of the dust of the earth. The second man is of heaven. As was the earthly man, so are those who are of the earth. And as is the heavenly man, so also are those who are of heaven. And just as we have borne the image of the earthly man, so shall we bear the image of the heavenly man. I declare to you, brothers and sisters, that flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, nor does the perishable inherit the imperishable. Listen, I tell you a mystery. We will not all sleep, but we will all be changed. In a flash, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet. For the trumpet will sound, the dead will be raised imperishable, and we will be changed. For the perishable must clothe itself with the imperishable, and the mortal with immortality. When the perishable has been clothed with the imperishable, and the mortal with immortality, then the saying that is written will come true. Death has been swallowed up in victory. Where, O death, is your victory? Where, O death, is your sting? The sting of death is sin, and the power of the sin is the law. But thanks be to God, he gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, my dear brothers and sisters, stand firm. Let nothing move you. Always give yourself fully to the work of the Lord, because you know that your labor in the Lord is not in vain. Amen. So there we have the entire section. And as I said, that last verse that we're focusing on tonight starts with the word therefore, hence the slightly longer reading. So we're compelled to look at a lot of what was covered last week, and that's not some sort of judgment on Andrew's Bible study last week. It's just required from the language here. So let's just double check this. So let's just look at this again. Verse 58. Therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. So, this verse, this therefore verse about the labours not being in vain, is in a context. It's in a really focused context on essentially what's going to happen when we die. Or when Christ returns and those who don't have to die are changed, as it were. So at the very end of time, or for those who have died beforehand. That is the context of the labours. And that's really important to keep in our minds. When we're looking at the labours not being in vain, it is in this context of the sure knowledge of the resurrection. And that slightly changes how we would look at this, how we'd go about this. So, on your sheets that look like this, you'll have one which has a number one at the bottom left-hand side. That's obviously going to be page one. Please, could we start there? That would be appreciated. What I want to ask, I mean, you've got a whole list there. You've got your key verse at the top, the one that I've repeated now a few times, and then the context. What do these texts teach us about the resurrection? Because I'm wanting us to really think about the resurrection, kind of mindful of what we looked at last week, but particularly here. I've chosen some verses. There are many, many more that could have been chosen, but I felt that these were apposite to bring out the lessons that were in 1 Corinthians. So, what we're going to do is we're going to take 10 minutes. We're going to look at these texts. If you spend all 10 minutes on one text, that's okay, as long as you've got a really good answer, as it were, 10 minutes from now. But what I want you to do is to look at these texts with this question, and this question for each of them: what do these texts teach us about the resurrection? Now, we've all got something invested in finding out the answer, because this affects each and every one of us. So, what do these texts, Daniel, John, Job, Philippians, and 1 John, what do they teach us about the resurrection? And in 10 minutes' time, we'll stop again to, you know, try and find out, to pull together what we've worked out from these texts, and to then really talk about it and how it relates to 1 Corinthians before we can really move on to our key verse. Please work in pairs, trios, whatever's essentially comfortable. If you really don't like the person you're sitting next to, you better move quickly, because they're looking at you now. Yes, indeed, in order to pair up. So, pairs, trios, no more than four, so you all get a chance to speak. Okay, guys? So you have 10 minutes starting just now. Thank you. We'll call time there. So, we're going to work our way through some of these texts. Please feel free to throw some ideas we'll kind of pool our knowledge together, as it were, on these verses. So, we have this wonderful opening the idea of the resurrection of the dead. So we're going to start with Daniel 12, 2-3. Would anyone like to just kick off, as it were, and tell me what they or even their group were thinking? You don't have to sign up to it. You can pretend it was someone else in your group if you're not too sure. But, you know, what were you thinking about this text?
Something that troubled us. It says in the translation you selected, it says, and many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall wake. Well, I notice in the Bible's Church Supply it says multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake. Mm-hmm. And I was told that you would have selected this translation very, very carefully.
Yes. Yes.
So we were, I think. We would have preferred the one in the church Bible.
Yes, we would have done, wouldn't we? The reason I've chosen the one that I have is because of the problem it raises, because of this almost theological grenade it goes off when we read it. Now, in actual fact, based on Hebrew, I would have preferred multitudes as a better translation. But it is the notion of the many as opposed to many of those. Now, that's a much easier thing for us to deal with. Everyone rises, and then he gets sorted it after that. But it's interesting. I mean, whole branches of doctrine and theology have arisen on the basis of one word in an English translation. And, you know, you can have a whole theology come out of here. So you got some who are raised for glory, some for contempt, and the others maybe just, you know, disappear. And a whole branch of theology can emerge from a slightly imprecise translation. That's been done on purpose, to open up this can of worms, as it were. The point is that here, it's actually talking about the people of God, first of all. So, the idea that there'd be two judgments, as it were, one for the people of God and one for everyone else, is not something that is just for the Old Testament. That carries over into the New Testament as well. We have a multitude of views as Christians, but the Old Testament notion of there being two separate forms of judgment, one for the people of God, and within there, some for glory and some for everlasting contempt. Or as Jesus puts it, you know, these people will come up to him and say, oh, I did this for you, I did that for you, I did this for you. He goes, I never knew you. Be gone. You know, there is a category of people who can be turning up on Judgment Day and are told, no, within these categories. So to be fair to Daniel, that's more where he's going with. He's talking about what's happening to those people, as it were. And fortunately, we have other texts to parallel it with to ensure that the knowledge that everybody is raised from the dead is a sure and certain thing. Hence, of course, we've got John to follow it, who will say that all, and there's absolutely no doubt as to what he means by this, every single person who has died. Now, it says all who are in the tombs, but it doesn't mean everyone who actually managed to have a tomb, if you know what I mean. It's just a way of saying everyone who died. So, however we deal with Daniel, and personally I think multitudes is a better translation anyway, it's good to also see these other texts which help balance out to know that whatever he meant, it doesn't mean that we can have a doctrine which says, well, some people are raised and some stay in the grave. Yeah, good. Just out of interest, how many other people were a little bit kind of disconcerted by that bit? Two. Okay. Clearly the rest of you were focused elsewhere in the text. Okay, so what else happens in Daniel? What do you think is important here as we're going to be looking at 1 Corinthians? Yeah, it's very clear. It's very precise. That there is a resurrection, there is no doubt whatsoever here. That we will awake at some point in the future, though we sleep in the dust. And there are two options, and only two options. I love the way that that one of them is described in the second part, you know. And those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the sky above, and those who turn many to righteousness, like the stars forever and ever. What a great phrase that is. Those who turn many to righteousness. I know, what does that mean? Yes, yeah. Very much so. I mean, we may be, you know, thinking, you know, turn those to righteousness means, you know, we've managed to enforce the rules extra well this week. There's a lot more extra righteous people because I've made them cover this up and do that and do the next thing. Well, that's not quite what it means. I mean, obviously, you know, turn to righteousness means to turn to be like the one who is righteous. In the New Testament understanding, that's an actual status, righteous, unrighteous. You know, Christian and not. In the New Testament, in the Old Testament, it's talking about the people of God becoming like God in their actions. So they would be living a life that would be how God would live it, as it were. They've got a very different kind of mindset in the Old Testament because they're just simply working within the people of God, whereas in the New Testament they're thinking about the people out with. And so there's a slightly different way of thinking about it, but it fundamentally comes down to the same thing, which is being right with the one who is righteous. You know? Imagine getting to glory and you're standing there and there's all these people there who are there because of what God did through you. All these eternal destinations changed because God was willing to use you in a moment. He was willing to use you as the person to speak a word or to tell people or to just simply be there when you saw them give their lives to Christ. Imagine standing there in glory and there's a whole group of people there because God is willing to use you. Now, I my mind just can't quite deal with that, if I'm entirely honest. It's too big for me to deal with in some regards. But that's essentially what's going on. And those people, who have turned many to righteousness, be like the stars forever and ever. How would that affect us in the present, do you think? This is something that we're always going to be kind of coming back to when we're thinking of the resurrection. And you've got these two options. There are two options, but one of the options, you know, once you've dealt with yourself, you know, contempt, or, you know, the slightly better option, and once you've dealt with yourself, how does that second part there changes in the present? Or how should it change us in the present? Yes, to a great degree, yes. I mean, when you look at that, you know, the brightness of the sky above, who turn many to righteousness, like the stars forever and ever, it should not simply be a verse that makes you think, oh, the future looks pretty. It should be a verse that makes you think that there's something for us to do now, if you see what I mean. Far too much of the resurrection talk and future times talk is very much allowing people to almost bypass the present and simply think of a nicer time in the future. And that is insufficient. Now, don't get me wrong, we get an awful lot of hope as to what's going to be in the future. And it can help us keep going in the worst of times. But verses like this, which talk about turning many to righteousness, when we know there is one option or the other, should change how we are. And what we do and what we say. And being willing to be open to that opportunity, that wonderful opportunity to be able to stand in glory one day and standing opposite you is someone who was saved right in front of you. When you were there, when their eternal destination changed. Okay, well, I'm pretty excited by that, but I can see we're going to need a little bit more to warm you up. Okay, so what about the second one? Okay, New Testament, this should be a little bit easier. John 5, 8 to 9, it says, sorry, do not marvel at this, for an hour is coming when all who are in the tombs will hear his voice and come out, those who have done good to the resurrection of life and those who have done evil to the resurrection of judgment. Which is very much a parallel to the Daniel passage. So what do we make of that?
It's very similar to Romans, beginning of Romans, isn't it? Paul says something that's the same.
Yes.
It's very clear that all we've been taught about justification by faith would appear not to be correct, because it is obviously justification by works.
Clearly it is, yes. Just as well you're here tonight to find this out. Yes. Sometimes when we do take things out, you know, we can be in real trouble. But what is interesting is that there's an awful lot of material, and we'll be looking an awful lot about it, actually, on the other half, as it were, a lot of material about what you do on earth having a consequence on that judgment day. Now, it shouldn't be taken, and again, one of the reasons I've taken this is because that's exactly how it can be misconstrued. Salvation is a wonderful gift of God. But there does appear to be something on the day of judgment that is down to how we've lived. And we're going to be looking at that in more detail, as I said, in just a moment. We'll be talking about storing up treasures and furnaces and all manner of different things that will describe this kind of thing. But there is something in the future that is carried over from the present. There is something about who we are and what we do now that will still be there in eternity. Now, how many of us are excited by that? How many of us have a small sense of dread at the prospect that something of us as we are carries over to eternity? Okay, a couple of nods there and some people not willing to meet my eye, so I'll take that as an affirmative also. Okay. Now, we're going to be looking at that, as I said, in more detail. But again, do we see the stark possibilities? And do we also see that quite clearly there is a resurrection? Of that, there is no doubt. So we're going to look a little bit with these next verses to look at what kind of resurrection. So when we look at Job, what kind of resurrection do we see here? What information about the resurrection do we gather from that text? Yes, we have a bodily resurrection. Now, so far there are two things that cannot be put aside. One, there is a resurrection, of that there should be no doubt. Two, it's going to be a bodily resurrection. Not some sort of intangible, incorporeal existence, you know, kind of floating around heaven type thing. But instead, not only do we have the example of Christ, noted, of course, that we're going to bear his image in Corinthians, but we have this ancient acknowledgement, as we have in Job, there's going to be something physical, something tangible, real. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, yet in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself. And my eyes shall behold, and not another. My heart faints within me. And in the Hebrew it's very, very clear, because he actually repeats himself to some extent, which is considered redundant in our English text, but let me just say it. In the Hebrew text it says, my eyes and no one else's. That's what he says. He kind of almost repeats himself, as it were, about the fact that it's going to be his actual eyes that will see God. You can't get a much clearer statement on bodily resurrection, though I have included two more. You can't get a clearer statement. And I find this really, truly wonderful. Now, the Old Testament understanding was that you are you. The Hebrew people had no concept of a soul. That's a Greek concept that comes in later on, and we add it retrospectively to some Old Testament texts. We have to wait until Hades and the underworld. We have to wait until we have all the kind of the Greek mythology before we come up with the concept of a soul. You see, the Hebrew people saw you as you. You were a human being. You were a human being. You were a living and breathing one. There wasn't a bit of you which could be extracted and float off into the ether. You were you. And what that meant was that when you died and when you woke up again, you were still going to be you. And your own body was going to be redeemed. God didn't just redeem a bit of you, he redeemed all of you. Now, we can disagree with him if we wish. There's been much Christian thoughts and theories and ideas, and Christianity has got a wide variety of views as to what happens when after we die. But the Old Testament is in absolutely no doubt, and I would strongly suggest that the New Testament is in correlation with it. You die, and you get raised up. There's not a bit of you left behind. There's not a bit of you that God couldn't redeem. He redeems all of you. Now, what that actually means, we're not entirely sure. You know, so what does a perfected Ian Hepburn look like? We don't know. But I will be me. But I'll be a better me. I'll be a perfected me. I'll be a fixed me. I won't need my glasses, for starters. All the men, of course, will be bald. I mean, surely, because clearly that's the look. Yes, I should try and avoid visual jokes for those listening, I realise, but nonetheless. We don't know what it means, but we do have a prototype. We do have an example. We have rising from the dead, his own body being raised. It wasn't left behind in the tomb and he was given a new one. It was his actual body being raised, and people were able to know who he was. He was confused with the gardener at first, kind of at dawn by a woman who was crying and who did not expect him to be alive. But essentially, what was intrinsically him was there. And it said that we're going to be like that. Well, that's good enough for me. I'm not entirely sure what that will look like, sound like, but that promise alone is sufficient. But it means that my body will be redeemed in some way. Yeah, exactly. I'm glad you're sitting down too for that one. That's a pretty big thing. Okay, so let's look at Philippians 3, 21. He says, who will transform a lowly body to be like his glorious body by the power that enables him even to subject all things to himself. And the parallel to that in 1 John. Beloved, we are God's children now. And what we will be has not yet appeared. But we know that when he appears, we shall be like him, because we shall see him as he is. Wow. What a thing to be promised. You know, as I kind of get out of bed in the morning and desperately try and stand up, and everything creaks and groans and screams at me, go back to bed. This is a beautiful thing. But it's a truly incredible thing that we will be transformed like that. So let me just ask very quickly, before I go beyond that, what do you think that means for the future? It's a very nice promise for the future, but what does it mean for the present? What does it mean for us right now? Perseverance that should come out through this. I was acquainted with a man who was murdered for being a Christian in Pakistan. And what's really interesting is that we knew that his life would be in danger because he made no secret that he was a Christian and would actively seek to tell everybody about Christ, which is as good as signing yourself up to being executed. I'll be honest, there's a piece of me that thought, I don't know if I could do that. You know, I'm not overly keen on pain and death and all these sorts of things. And he was quite right. He pointed out that he is not jealous to protect his own body. He was not jealous to protect his own life and to protect his own body because, you know what? It's going to be remade. It's going to be reborn. It's going to be redeemed. And his main priority was not looking after his flesh, which was going to be remade to a much glorious extent anyway, but to be one of those who would stand there, you know, in the midst of those whose lives have been changed. Now, I'm kind of taken aback by it. I'm kind of not entirely sure if I can quite actually pull off what I'm going to say, but it should make that difference. It should make that difference. We shouldn't be jealous to protect ourselves and our flesh, or even our pride or our reputation or anything else, our status, you know, when we're actually talking about these eternal things. And that perspective change as to what God's going to do, even if it only works every now and again in our minds and lives, it's a big change. It's a big deal. And I've been struck by a number of people who have, through history, but also people who I've met, who have gone on knowing that their lives were forfeit. But so what? Their bodies were going to be remade. Whatever they did to them, it didn't matter. And I find that a truly challenging and staggering thing. But I can understand how, if we really grasp this, it can change us now. Another thing, though, is that it changes our view of death, I think. I think that's kind of where I'm going with that. It changes our view of death. As verse 54 in the 1 Corinthians passage said, when the perishable has been clothed with the imperishable, and the mortal with immortality, then the saying that is written will come true. Death has been swallowed up in victory. Now, this saying that is written, again, shows a wonderful solidarity between Old and New Testaments. That is, of course, Isaiah 25, verse 8, which says, and this is one of the most beautiful texts to do with the resurrection, in my opinion. He will swallow up death forever. And Yahweh Elohim will wipe away tears from all faces. And the reproach of his people he will take away from all the earth. For Yahweh has spoken. And it's beautiful. Because he has spoken it, it's guaranteed. It's as if it's been done. I love this. He'll swallow up death forever. So it's gone. And Yahweh Elohim will wipe away the tears from all faces. It's such a beautiful concept that very idea is repeated twice, of course, in the book of Revelation. And this attitude towards death is summed up, I think, here in this Corinthians passage in verse 55, which says, where, O death, is your victory? Where, O death, is your sting? Which, again, is a quotation from the Old Testament, Hosea 13, verse 14. In the knowledge that we will rise from the dead, our attitudes towards death should be different because it's not the end. We don't lose when we die. It doesn't change the very real anguish that we feel when we lose loved ones. And that should not be dismissed. The true, dreadful, terrible anguish that we feel. But it should change how we face death and how we deal with death. You know, when we're able to declare with our final breath, I am fully persuaded that he is able to keep that which I've committed unto him against that day. You know, to our final breath. And so, you know, I read the Psalms, like Psalm 23, which is a very common one to have read out at funerals and at times of death. And we notice we've got this valley of the shadow of death. What a wonderful phrase that is. I mean, a shadow can't actually touch you. A shadow can't actually do anything to you. And a shadow is only ever cast because of light. And though those of us on this side of the valley are left behind and in anguish, the person who goes through the valley of the shadow of death comes out into the light. It's a beautiful description of what goes on. I should also point out that God didn't invent death. It wasn't part of God's design to have death. That was part of man's additions to the created order. We ushered in death, despite the fact we were warned that this would be a consequence. And so we have sin. And I remember very clearly when my dad was dying that people would say, you know, how can you stand this? You know, he was 55 when he died. My sisters were much younger than me, so teenagers, young teenagers. How can you stand God doing this to you? And he pointed out, it's not God that's killing me. Sin is killing me. God's going to raise me up. And it changes how we face death. It changes how we approach things. Or at the very least, it should. So we have this idea of hope. And it's a real hope. But, and here's the difficult thing. When we focus again, as I said this a little bit earlier, when we focus on the future to this extent, and this glorious and wonderful future, there's a danger that we devalue the present, that we almost sort of ignore the present, we just wait, as it were. There's like a waiting time before we get to that more wonderful time and place. And we can be in the danger of overlooking the fact that the present has a huge effect on what happens after we die. And that's what kind of brings us finally to our key text of the night. It is this concept that yes, there is death, yes, there is resurrection, and yes, it is a wondrous thing that we have the context for the verse tonight, which is again, therefore, my dear brothers and sisters, stand firm. Let nothing move you. Always give yourself fully to the work of the Lord, because you know that your labor in the Lord is not in vain. So, in the context of Revelation, what does that verse mean? Now, you've got it at the top of your page one. In the context of all of what we've been saying so far, what does this verse mean? I'm just going to give you 5 minutes, because it's only one verse, to talk about it, and then I'll bring you back, as it were, to talk. All right, 5 minutes. Purely because we normally overrun slightly when I'm doing it, I suppose I'd better stop us there. So we're looking at, as it were, our verse for tonight in the context of these other texts we've looked at, within the context of this bodily resurrection, with the glorious body, etc. So what do we make of a verse for tonight in that context, which is very much trying to bring out what was being said in 1 Corinthians anyway? So what do we make of our verse?
Well, we can't be steadfast and immovable because our destination is sure and certain. So that's the very key connection.
Good. Yeah, absolutely. It is the means by which we remain steadfast in some regards. You know, this hope that we have, in the future is one of the reasons that we can be steadfast or called to be steadfast and immovable. Okay, good. What do we make of your labour is not in vain? What do you make of that?
If you do it as the outworking of what you've done, if it's what God placed you to do, the outworking of what you do is in God's hand.
Yes, yes, good, good. I mean, very much, you know, because it is very clearly talking about, the work of the Lord, as it were, not just randomly, anything you do is going to be blessed by God, you know. It's quite clear that it's, you know, the work of the Lord that you happen to be taking part in is not in vain. Does that make sense? Yes. Yes. Yeah. And I'm always worried whenever I read things like, you know, your labour is not in vain, if it's being cut out from the context and put into, you know, like some sort of promise, like a promise box or something, and someone's pulled that out for that day, your labour is not in vain. It's a very careful context to this. This is not carte blanche blessing from God no matter what you do. This is about the fact that when we labour for the Lord, it is not in vain. Now, there's a lot of Christian people, and there's a lot of people in the Bible that are there to remind us that even though externally it may look as if they're completely unsuccessful, the labor is not in vain. My favorite example that I always go back to is, of course, Jeremiah. Jeremiah, if he was alive today, would say, Jeremiah, it's not working for you. No one's getting saved. You're clearly not really called to this ministry. Do something else. Fortunately, God had different ideas. He was laboring, and it was not in vain. Despite the fact that by our measurements, you know, numbers of converts or amount of kudos he'd been receiving, he was very much on the lower end of the spectrum. So first of all, it should change how we view the working for the Lord and what it means that it's not in vain. That's the first thing, I suppose. What else? Good. So it's looking at what is the work. It's got very much to do with God investing in people and seeing a transformation, first of all, in their eternal destination, and then beyond that, in a continued transformation, as it were. So when we're trying to understand what the work is that's going on, that is essentially at its core. When we look at the labour of the Lord is not in vain, this is absolutely 100% true, but it's true in two ways, I suppose. Firstly, the labour, the work, belongs to the Lord. It doesn't belong to us. It's not my work that I'm doing that God is blessing. It is his work. So you know what? When I die, it's not that the work suddenly stops. It's not as if everything that I'd invested my life into was suddenly gone up in smoke, because I was merely subcontracted, as it were, to take part in what God was already doing. So that's the first thing to understand. The work of the Lord, you know, we take part in that. And it's not in vain. No matter how successful or unsuccessful we can be judged, it's not in vain, because it's his work and he will accomplish what he wishes to accomplish. So that's the first way in which it can be understood that it's not in vain. However, there's another way in which it can be understood, and a way which is a little bit more relevant in the context of 1 Corinthians and relevant, hopefully, in what we've been talking about so far tonight. There is an eternal nature to what we do. It is not in vain because we carry over into eternity. and who we are and what we've done and the lives that we have lived in some way carry over into eternity. So, as it's a rather terrifying concept for many of us, I can see, we're going to look at a number of texts to try and understand what that means, that something of us carries over for eternity, that we perfected will be there and that our lives lived here have an effect there. We're going to have a look at some texts to try and understand what that means, to try and tie that down. So that takes us to page 2, as it were, entitled Viewing Life. I've talked about how we should view death, but how should we view life? We shouldn't just be thinking of death and the future. We should be thinking of life. We should be thinking of now. And we should be thinking that because the labour is not in vain, there's something about that now that will carry over. And so I put in brackets, storing up treasures in heaven. And most of you will have heard that phrase, storing up treasures in heaven. Yeah, good. I'm getting about 3/4 of you at least nodding. So that's good. I'm going to take that as a yes for the majority. I'll take that as a pass. Storing up treasures in heaven. So what do these texts teach us about the effect of the present on the future? Now, what we're going to do is we're going to break this down a little bit more. We're going to do one at a time. I'm just going to give you a couple of minutes to briefly look at what is a rather well-known text, Matthew 6, 19 to 20. I want to just give you a couple of minutes to read it, to talk about it, and to say, what does this teach us about this idea of taking something from the present into eternity? Okay, so just take a couple of minutes to do that now. Thank you. So sorry to interrupt you now, because I can see that we're actually getting somewhere in some of the groups there. I could hear some pretty good things. But of course, that raises the bar when I start asking you what they mean, as it were. So I could hear some pretty good things in quite a few of the groups there. And I saw lots of writing going on. So that fills me with hope as I look to you. And I say, okay, so Matthew 6, 19 to 20. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. So what do we make of that in the context of something carries over? Yes, bearing in mind that I heard most of you say the right answer just a moment ago. Yes. Yes, I think many of you are underestimating how much of the primary teacher still resides within me. I know most of your names. So, seriously, what do we think about this text?
Well, in verse, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also.
Mm. Yes. Now, this is primarily about your priorities in life and how you live your life now, conscious of the future. Would that be a fair way of summing it up? So, if our priorities now are to be very much aligned with God and very much sorted out because of the future, what exactly here does, you know, do we have that kind of suggests that, well, what impact is it going to have? And if my priorities are elsewhere, if my priorities are actually to make as much money as possible and to have some lovely clothes and all these sorts of things, does it really matter? Phew, thank you. Yes, I was beginning to worry for you there. I said, well, no, clearly not. Yes, it does matter. You know, where your heart will be also is a pretty significant statement. We can be bedazzled by so many things. And things which are inconsequential, things that really don't matter when we understand things from a heavenly perspective, from an eternal perspective. There is a rather unclear but way of describing it, I suppose, but the idea of laying up treasures in heaven as opposed to earth. There is something that we can almost store in heaven, lay up in heaven, as opposed to focusing, storing and laying up our bank accounts or our vaults or our cellars or whatever it is, or wherever it is, our mattresses, whatever you store your valuables in, as it were. There is something, maybe not spelled out here, but there is something that we can do now that affects eternity. Would that be a fair statement? Yeah. Now, we get more detail in the ones that follow. But this is a big deal. You know, we're not just sitting around waiting for eternity. There is something that we can do now that completely separate from salvation, which is not to be worked at. Something separate from that. Something that to be treasured. Something valuable. Something wonderful. And our present affects the extent to which this is true in eternity. Now, how many of us are slightly unnerved by that? No one? I mean, I'm one. Okay, I'll count myself as the lone person in the room then. To be slightly unnerved by that. I mean, everything we know about God is that he looks at you and he doesn't value you for the things that you do, and he doesn't value you for the things that you can give him for his kingdom. He looks at you and he is willing to die for you. You have value as a living and breathing one, as Genesis puts it. You have value as a human being, the extent to which cost him his life. So the idea that we can be storing up treasures in heaven, the idea that we can be getting some extra added value, should be disconcerting in some ways. It might appeal to our sense of fairness and fair play that those who have done much better in their lives get a better reward. But I find it deeply disconcerting because it slightly goes against the very nature of God that I've been raised to understand through my reading of the text.
Could it not be that we will look back and we will either regret things that we didn't do or that we did do perhaps, or we will get the value of where we have done the good things, we will get the value. We ourselves will get pleasure from that.
Good, yes. There is something of value in the good things that we do that impinge upon us in glory. Now, I'm going to suspend that for a moment. That's essentially where we're going to keep on coming back to through these texts. There is something that is going to benefit us, as it were, in glory. Not so much the idea of God sitting there with his big bag of rewards, and he'll give some to Jeffrey, and then he'll look at Esther and think, well, maybe not today, Esther. You know, and then he'll give some to Amy and things. You know, that's not what we're supposed, I mean, although that's how it's very often understood, that's not quite how we're supposed to grasp this. And yet, there seems to be a hint of this in these other texts. So, let's just look at the next one in 1 Timothy 6, verse 18 to 19. They are to do good. To be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, thus storing up treasure for themselves as a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is truly life. So we've got this concept of treasure again, but we've now got a little bit more detail as to what this impact is going to be, as it were. So what do we make of that verse? What does it add that we don't have already? Yes. Yes, indeed. I'm not even going to add much more. That was a very good answer. There is very much. That does seem to be the case. It does seem to be the case. Okay. So let's take the next one as well in Revelation 20. We'll start with verse 12. And I saw the dead, the great and the small, standing before the throne, and the books were opened. Then another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged by what was written in the books according to what they had done. Now, what's worrying about that before we get to the next bit, which is the context which actually helps an awful lot? What's a bit worrying about that verse? Yes, yes, you're standing there and you can be judged by God based on what you've done. Pretty much the same as most other religions, as it were, you know. So are you a good boy or girl? Here's your reward. Are you not? Be gone. That's what it looks like there, yes? Although there is talk of two books, just to complicate things. But I have to point out, it is in the context of verse 15, which says, "And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire." And so there's a very important separation here, as it were. There is salvation, verse 15, as it were, which is independent from being judged on your works. If that makes sense. If I can illustrate it, as it were, give an example of how I would imagine something which is utterly unimaginable. I stand before the throne of judgment. I'm standing there before God. There's no veil to hide behind like there was in the tabernacle or the temple. I've got to stand before God, and the books are opened. And all those books are probably just on what I've done. And I'm standing there, and God's about to start judging. And at that point, the other book is also opened, and Jesus Christ stands up and says, "He's one of mine. He is one of mine." And whatever it says in those books does not matter to the extent of where I end up. Whatever it says in those books, in terms of my life, it does not matter if I've been the greatest Christian, the worst Christian. All that matters is that I love the Lord Jesus Christ, and he has acknowledged that I am one of his. Done. That's salvation. And yet, there appears to be a moment whereby the things that I have done actually do matter. The things that I have done, these treasures or lack of, really come to roost, really come to bear. We can add to that a lot of the parables that Jesus used, the parable of the talents in Matthew 25, and other examples of this sort of thing. There appears to be something about what we do that matters. And I want to get away with the idea that it only matters for an instant, as if, you know, there's a moment of judgment on your life and then it no longer matters. It seems to matter. These treasures seem to matter to a much larger extent, other than on some sort of reward day, as it were. So, I've got a bit of a problem, if I'm honest. This really strikes a kind of a wrong chord in me, as I was mentioning just before. It doesn't seem quite right. The idea of God sitting in heaven and holding back and just kind of looking at us and thinking, well, you've earned it. Here's a bit for you. You haven't. Sorry. you can get a little bit, you know. And that just really grates in my mind as to who God is. The very magnanimity of God, the mercy and grace of God, is suddenly in that moment reversed. If we have that notion of what's going on. It fails to understand God. It fails to understand the effect of the present on the future. And so we need to understand that it is not God who is limiting what we receive, as it were. A better way to conceive of it would be to understand that life here prepares us for eternity. And the life that we lead now will affect us in the future. You see, I believe that God is going to give and give and give. I believe that God is going to be utterly abundant with his blessings. The difference is how much we can receive. Our capacity to receive is changed by the lives that we live. So, God is going to give you 100%. But your 100% is going to be different from someone else's 100% because of the amount that we can receive. A very common analogy to describe us would be jars in the hands of a potter. And when we're being formed and shaped in our life, you know what? Your capacity might be huge to receive from God. And someone else's capacity might be small. God's going to give 100%. Fill it up to the brim. But it's different amounts, as it were. And we've got to understand it's not God who's limiting what is being given. It is very much how we live, because it really determines how much we're able to receive. The extent to which you live a life in tune with God and open to God is going to change how much you can be open to God in the future. You don't just suddenly change. You're not replaced. You're still you. And the idea is that you are still going to be you. I perfected you in glory. And what you're able to receive from God is going to be linked to what you're able to receive now, because you're still you. And so God is giving 100%. But what we can actually receive, what we're able to take, can be different. And that's a better way of understanding things, rather than understanding this God who sits there and holds back, as it were. A God who gives, and will give as much as you can take. But the amount that you can take will be different, depending on the lives that we have lived. Now, I find that a much more useful, a much more helpful way of understanding the nature of God and the nature of what we do here affecting the future. It also shows why what we do is not in vain, because there is something about working with and for God that changes us, that sees us in eternity different. It's not in vain. Every single thing we do for God is not in vain. Even though we look at it and think, well, that didn't work, that was no use, it's not in vain, because God is changing us. God is forming us and the people that we will be. Well, I am also filled with incredible wonder and hope when we're also told that we will be transformed from glory to glory. So it's not as if, oh, you missed the deadline, that's you stuck for eternity, that's you. The idea is that actually when you get there, this idea of being transformed from glory to glory, so the idea that it's not even the end of the process, but that we continue to be open to receiving from God. Which is a kind of a phew moment, I must confess. But again, should not detract from the present. This is why it should not be that we just kind of look forward to the future alone. There's hope in the future. There's this wonder about the future. But we don't just simply look to it and ignore the present. So I've got one last text I want to use. And it's a text that used to scare me as a child, I'll be entirely honest, and gives me hope as an adult. Now, if anyone builds on the foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each one's work will be manifest, for the day will disclose it, because it will be revealed by fire, and the fire will test what sort of work each one has done. If the work that anyone has built on the foundation survives, he will receive a reward. If anyone's work is burned up, he will suffer loss, though he himself will be saved, but only as through fire. So let me again reiterate, this is not about salvation. This is about something other than that. This is about the depth of relationship we have with God. And this is a really interesting one. As a child, I had this terrifying notion of your life going through a furnace and you're kind of standing there going, oh no, what's going to come out? Is there going to be anything coming out at the other end? As an adult, I have a very different understanding. I have this wondrous, praise-filled relief when I read something like this, because my life is going to go through a furnace. So see all the stuff that I wish wasn't there? It gets burned up so that it's not there. And all the stuff, the good stuff, the stuff that is not in vain, the stuff that's in the work of the Lord, it survives. And you see it for what it is in the absence of all the rubbish. Pure gold. And it's not really about how much gold is there, looking at that one. It's very much about all the bad stuff that we wish wasn't there, that had got in the way of the work of the Lord, will be gone. We don't need to look at it anymore. We'll only have the gold. And from that moment on, we'll be going from glory to glory. Now, as an adult, that's no longer scary. As an adult, that again fills me with praise for a God who would do that for me. It doesn't make me sit kind of on the naughty step for eternity looking at what I did and what I did wrong. He burns it all away and says, right, this is what you have. Now let's go for eternity. It's a beautiful thing. Okay, so let me caveat it all by pointing out that we do not really understand how eternity works. what it's going to look like, etc. These are these scrabblings kind of in the twilight that we are given through the revelation here. But we know that our bodies are going to be raised. We know that we are going to be raised from the dead. We know that there are two possible outcomes, and what a wonderful and glorious thing it would be if we saw a whole lot of people with a changed outcome because of the work that God was willing to do through us in the present. Now, that would be gold. We know these things, and we know that there is something of us that carries on into the future, perfected us, but we're still ourselves. And our ability to love God, our ability to receive from God, which is being stretched and developed here, and through all the hard times in our life, well, we're those same people when we get to glory, and we'll be able to love him and receive from him to the same capacity, though we will be perfected. It's also beautiful that that's not the end of the story, but just the beginning. And even if we have nothing, the idea of being transformed from glory to glory through eternity, forever being better and better able to love and receive, is a beautiful thing. So it should not dull us to the opportunities in the present. It should make us hopeful about the future, but it should also make us grasp every opportunity we have to be storing up gold. Okay, let's pray. Heavenly Father, we heartily acknowledge that we see only dimly what it is that lies before us. We have various promises, we have various things that are said, but Lord, we acknowledge we do not fully grasp what is to happen, but we know without a shadow of a doubt that what we do for you is not in vain. We know that we can stand steadfast and unmovable because your work continues. And I pray, Heavenly Father, that you would enable us to have the privilege of taking part this week. Let us have the privilege of storing up something in heaven. Let us have the privilege of changing, of being transformed every day. I pray, Heavenly Father, you give us the time to be the people that we will be for eternity. In Jesus' wonderful name, amen. Thank you.